Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl. It's me again. Sorry, Molly's... I don't even know where Molly is. I think she's on vacation, but she might be doing something professional. I actually don't know. But you can ask yourself on Twitter. She's at Molly Wood. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. You know the drill. We talk about stuff, and then we get your thoughts on stuff, and then we go away being smarter because, wait for it, here it is. None of us is as smart as all of us. So here's what we're going to do this week. We talked last week about a podcast called Slow Burn, about season two of the podcast from Slate Plus, and a guy by the name of Leon Neyfakh, about his series that season one of which looked at Watergate and season two of which looked at the Clinton impeachment. We're going to talk about another guy who's got a podcast and a bunch of other stuff this week, but in a little bit less of a constructive way to society, shall we say. I'm going to guess by now most of you have heard of a guy by the name of Alex Jones and his platform, his site, his format, his forum, if you will, called InfoWars. He is not really connected to reality, you could probably say. He is out there online and on video and all kinds of stuff, saying things like the September 11th attacks were an inside job, that the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting was a government hoax. He has done the only words to use are vile and despicable things. In the name of what I'm going to guess is partisan politics, but also just sowing general discontent. And we're talking about him this week because of what happened last week, which is that a bunch of major platforms, and I'm talking like Facebook, Google, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, I mean, a bunch of other platforms kicked him off. They took his information down. They said, we're not going to have it because this is hate speech and we are simply not doing that. The question I want to think about today, though, is why now? Because Alex Jones has been around for a very long time. He's been saying this stuff for a very long time. And yet in the past, you know, I don't know, 6 months, maybe year and a half, he's gotten way more high profile. Now, part of that is because of the current political environment, right? Donald Trump has been on Alex Jones's show. The president says divisive things as a matter of course. And that all contributes to the conversation we're having in this country. So the conversation we're going to have right now is with a woman by the name of Kate Klonick. She is an assistant professor at St. John's Law School. She's a fellow at Yale as well. She does the Information Society Project there. And we're going to hash this out a little bit and talk about why now, what happens, what are the ramifications, and where maybe things are going to go from here. Kate, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Let me do one thing, first of all, and I'm not sure when you did constitutional law in law school. It's probably like a first-year thing, right?
Yep.
Yeah, one would hope. This is not a First Amendment deal, right? Facebook and all of those taken down, Alex Jones does not give him a First Amendment claim.
No, not at all. First Amendment claims only arise if it's the government that's stopping someone from talking or someone from speaking about something. But Apple, Facebook, all of these platforms, they're private entities and they can decide who speaks on their platforms and who doesn't.
Okay, so Facebook and all the rest of them, they can do this whatever they want, right?
Yeah, and actually, I think that, you know, to get to your question of why this is happening now, this has been actually happening for a long time. It's been happening for at least since 2005, really kind of in earnest at Facebook since 2008, 2009, in which they were really kind of decided to start moderating user-generated content and the content that was posted on their sites. But it's suddenly kind of catching, you know, the public's consciousness that this is something that these platforms are doing.
Okay, so let me ask you about the platform that has decided Alex Jones and his hate speech is not violating any of its rules. Because let's be clear here, what Facebook and YouTube and all the rest of them said was, this is a violation of our terms of service, in essence, and we're going to take it down. Twitter and Jack Dorsey, the CEO, has said, we can't find a rules violation, so we're going to let him stay up. Discuss.
Yeah, well, I mean, they make the rules, right? So those rules can change whenever they want them to. And so if they decide someday that Alex Jones does violate the rules, they don't have to be inconsistent with their previous statement. They get to make whatever it is the standard is going to be for what constitutes hate speech. And so that's kind of a really interesting question, which is kind of how it is that these platforms are setting those rules, what they think that they're reflecting. You know, if they're reflecting the norms of their users, a really great question to ask is which users? The users in the U.S., the users globally, the users in Europe? It gets to be a really hard question.
So to that end, actually, and reflecting the views of its users, here comes what is going to come across as a really... I guess somewhat despicable question, but here goes. Is it possible that somewhere in Twitter's internal deliberations, they said, look, we need people to come to our site. We need people to use Twitter. And even though it's hateful, and even though what he says is vile and horrible and ruins people's lives, there is a business case advantage to keep him here so that the people who want to hear Alex Jones can come here.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely part of the metric that I think that they're balancing. But I would say that people probably are overstating how much money or how much engagement something like Alex Jones brings in for something like Twitter from just a very monetary mm-hmm. standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you know, they might get just as much backlash of people quitting the platform for not taking him down.
Yeah.
And so, there's really, it's hard to decide, like, where you're going to draw that line. But yeah, of course, I think that that's a decision that they're making. I think that the bigger decision it seems like Twitter is making is what they want their identity to be and their values to be as a platform. And they've gone back and forth on this a lot in the last 10 years. I mean, they started out as the free speech platform for the free speech party. And they had a very absolute free speech stance. And then they've walked that back a lot in response to harassment and other types of things the last few years. So it's interesting that they're making a stand on this now.
Did you see the piece in the New York Times maybe 3, 4, 5 days ago, a week ago, that the Twitter had let the Times into one of its big, not all hands, but certainly a large meeting about where they discussed all this kind of stuff? And it read to me like they honestly kind of can't make up their minds.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can make up their minds. I think that I loved that piece, and I thought that it was, and this conversation is a great conversation because of this. I don't know if you had to think about how you were going to do any of this or how you're going to make a policy like this and enforce it consistently. I think any of us would have a really hard time doing it. I think judges have a hard time doing it or have had a hard time doing it in First Amendment cases over the mm-hmm. years. I think that newsrooms have had a really hard time doing this. And now we're kind of seeing these public platforms struggle with it, and I think it's really difficult.
Well, look no farther than Morning Edition the other day, right? I'm assuming a lot of people who listen to this podcast listen to public radio writ large and Morning Edition, and having the guy who staged the Unite the Right rally on, right? And where is the balance there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want it to. I mean, the comparison that's always used is you don't want to give, you know, a platform to Hitler, right? But I mean, no one knew that Hitler was Hitler before, in the process.
Yeah, but wait, because now we know. Now we know Hitler was Hitler. And these guys are saying some of the things that Hitler said.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, like, but then you run into a second problem, which is like, do you not publish their speech and let them say it where they want to say it?
Right.
Or do you let them go and like find it in the dark corners of the internet? And, you know, is it better that we can keep an eye on all of it at least and kind of have a nice sense that it's out there? You know, that's one of the problems you have with kicking terrorists and extremists off these major platforms. But they have, I think that now they're kind of realizing that taking down some of this stuff really does make it a lot more difficult for these ideas to spread. And so I think that's one of the main empirical reasons that people are finally like kind of getting on the train of taking more of this stuff down.
Yeah. Do you know who Jonah Goldberg is?
Yeah.
Okay. So for those who don't, he's a conservative writer and commentator. He is actually on public radio. Sometimes he writes for the National Review and he does a weekly column, which is usually thoughtful. And this past weekend was spot on. And he was talking about a lot of things, but one of which was this InfoWars thing and viewpoints like that. And the companies that we have talked about so far in this interview taking him down. And here's one of the things he said, and I'll just read it. When it falls to a bunch of giant corporations or the federal government to decide what speech is permissible, it is usually a sign that the rest of civil society has failed to do its job. That's the end of the quote. I think that's kind of spot on.
I think that's spot on, too. I mean, I think that one of the things that I write about is that these are not just corporations. This isn't like oil. Like, this isn't some giant oil corporation or, Kellogg or like something else, right? Or a pharma company. Mm. These are giant transnational companies that basically have democratized speech and access to publication in a way that we've never seen before in all of human history.
Which is a positive, right? That statement right there is a good thing. We want that.
No. Completely. Right. And, you know, and that's exactly right. And they are governing transnationally, like without like with like relative like non-regard to borders. But like we just they're as strong and as significant as nation states and as governments. And I think that his point is exactly right. It is really time for civil society to step in. It is time for users to step in. It is time for there to be a pushback in the same way that we would push back against a government.
What do you think that pushback looks like, though? Do we stop using Twitter because they're still having Alex Jones up there?
Well, I think that the reason that these things stay, that the only pressure point for any of these platforms is not really money necessarily, but relevance. I think that they need to stay relevant and they need to become, you need to keep engaging, but not even just keep engaging, they need to be popular. When they don't reflect the policies of the users, that's their soft spot. They have to kind of be doing the things that make people want to keep going on them. So it's not just not using them. It's like a kind of a broader picture of using that pressure point to kind of create a good reputation for their company that makes them, gives them staying power.
Yeah. What do we do with the fact that, without any religious connotation here, in this area, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO and co-founder and controlling shareholder of Facebook, has basically become God?
Oh, no, I think that is exactly right. I think he's a benevolent dictator. Yeah. I think that he is very much a benevolent dictator. I think that he is, there could be a lot worse people in power for this type of things, but that's kind of the other thing I was going to say, that these are not like corporations that we typically think of, oil or whatever else, because they're controlling rights that we have. Like they're controlling fundamental rights to privacy and expression that typically we don't sign over those types of rights to companies. And so this is kind of why he is especially kind of like a dictator or a governor, because he has created a system of governance.
I wonder if, and certainly, you know, I've said that he just doesn't get it and doesn't understand. And Molly and I have had this conversation repeatedly, both on Marketplace and on this podcast. I wonder if maybe he's a little paralyzed.
Oh, I think that there's a lot going on. I mean, I hear things through the grapevine, but there's, I think that it is a little paralyzing. I think that it's a lot of power for a guy who just wanted to make a Rolodex that worked on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, it just is, so to kind of think what this has become, I don't think any of us, and I mean any of us, meaning like the world, could have foreseen what today's world would look like with Facebook 10 years ago, even Mark Zuckerberg. So, yeah, I think it is probably very daunting, but I think he's very serious about changing it. And that's the benevolent part of the dictatorship.
Yeah,
I think that he does want to ultimately reflect, do the right thing for the users. But it's unclear if he can do that without pissing everyone off.
Right. Can we talk here for a second, since you are a lawyer, about the law and about what makes these platforms not be liable, I guess, in a way, for the content that is produced?
Yeah, well, at least in the U.S., there's a, in 1997, Congress passed a law called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And that was basically a law that meant that, you know, we hold things like the New York Times liable for defamation that they publish on their web pages. You can sue them for defamation. And it's one of the ways that we use as a check to kind of to do stuff. But very early on, they realized that the internet couldn't handle that type of, for scale reasons. So in order to basically kind of simultaneously encourage platforms to take down a lot of problematic content that was coming up, like spam and pornography and things like that, and hate speech, they decided to grant them immunity. And it was kind of very much, by giving them this blanket immunity from defamation and stuff, it meant that they could take down as much or as little as they wanted and create their own culture and their own kind of expression themselves within these sites.
So that law now is 20-something years old. Do we need to revisit?
Yeah, I mean, we are. There are a couple of bills on the floor right now.
Yeah, but Congress can't find its own backside with both hands, right?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you can't tell whether that's a good thing or not. there's been a lot of talk about revisiting it, about kind of creating carve-outs for bad actors that do not kind of hamstring Section 230. The nice thing about Section 230 is it's very hard to see what it would look like if you did start to introduce liability, because it just... One of the things that could happen is that platforms could start just taking everything down that looks hugely problematic. You'd have huge over-censoring, you know, just because it would be safer to take everything down than to like leave something up and have it, you know, have yourself get sued for it. Right. The other thing they could do is not take anything down, which would mean that we would be back in the world in which, you know, no one takes down trolls or hate speech and Alex Jones stays up, Nazis stay up, yeah. All of the things stay up. So those are kind of like the two worlds Section 230 straddles or tries to avoid.
So as a woman, just on the way out here, as a woman who thinks seriously about this stuff, and with the caveat that we're kind of winging it because we're in the middle of all this change as it's happening, now what?
There's something really amazing about the conversation about Alex Jones, because I think that it reflects that these platforms are susceptible to the pressures that users put on them. The other bad thing is that I think that it puts a lot of emphasis on kind of this outrage mechanism that seems to be the way that we react to things on the internet and in politics in general these days, that the more angrier we are, the more change we want right now, they change things. And then, like, you know, I bet you in 5 weeks, no one will even remember this Alex Jones incident.
Oh my God, that's probably true, right?
It's so true. Yeah. Like, there's actually, I've been doing this for a while, and I could list seven different things that if I mentioned them, you'd remember them. But you're like, I've never been this angry about anything before. It's like, actually, kind of have. but it does. So I think that the balance of those two things, getting in place kind of a responsiveness from platforms and then like trying to not make it too responsive. It's very much a constitutional convention type of problem, right? That they created with what they had to to deal with early on.
And putting on my history buff hat, you know what happened in the Constitutional Convention, right? They threw the old thing out and created something entirely new.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Oh, man. And I never even went to law school. Kate Klonick, she's at St. John's University School of Law. She's a fellow up at Yale as well. Kate, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
See ya. Well, how about that, huh? How about that? That was good stuff. If you've got more questions about InfoWars or you want to know what else we think about this stuff, because Molly and I will certainly tell you in a future episode if you like, let us know. Make me smart at marketplace.org. You can tweet at us. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Molly is at Molly Wood. I don't think she's on Twitter while she's off. So, you know, just wait till she gets back, which I don't know honestly when that is. I should, but I don't. Anyway, we're going to go. And it's time to hear from you when we come back. Mark in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, wrote to tell us how much he appreciates the way Marketplace presents in-depth news and tells offbeat economic stories he doesn't find any place else. If you agree with Mark, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to everybody who contributes to keep public service journalism strong.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
All right, we're back, and it is your turn.
Dear Make Me Smart, My name's Jessica from Austin.
This is Steve McGillivray from Fountain Hills, Arizona.
This is Sandra Bond in Newport, Oregon.
All right, so on that conversation that Kate and I were having, which honestly I'm still actually kind of thinking about, which is why I was pausing there for a moment. What ought to be allowed? What is civil in our public spaces? Joanna Ware from Boston left us this voice memo.
The short version of my thinking on the topic is be civil, but in the face of dehumanizing language, too much civil engagement runs the risk of giving validity to deeply dangerous positions. So I'm not interested in debating Nazis, and I do believe that it is appropriate for there to be social consequences to these kinds of behavior and positions.
So there is some other thoughts out there on tech companies. There are, rather, some other thoughts on whether those tech companies are platforms or publishers. David Owen tweeted this. He said, platforms aren't publishers, but, and here's the quote, when the platform includes an algorithm that shapes what you see on the feed, it begins to take on an editor publishing function. Yes, but that's not what the law says, David. And you heard Kate saying that they're thinking about changing it. But you also heard me saying, look, Congress can't agree on what day it is. Okay. Other subjects, trade questions. We've been doing a lot of trade because, oh my God, the news. Here's one from Bill Hunter. Grass Valley, California is where he is. It's a voice memo. Here you go.
I'm wondering why duties and tariffs don't just get earmarked into programs to support the industries they are purported to protect. Aside from discouraging bad behavior, the fees don't really seem to help anyone except the government. Do they even work? For example, the 18% tariff imposed on bags and cases produced from man-made textiles over the last 20-plus years hasn't brought luggage manufacturing back to the United States, and it hasn't discouraged companies from sourcing and consumers from buying foreign-made suitcases. Thanks for your help.
Yeah, so my guess is that they're not in legislation because they want, Congress, that is, and well, nominally Congress, right, because it's largely surrendered its tariff authorities. They want tariffs to be sort of extra legislative. They want them to be things of note that don't get tucked away into the legislative sausage-making process. I would also say probably an 18% tariff on bags and cases does not offset the amount of money that those manufacturers would save by making whatever they're making overseas. That is my guess. All right. Molly pointed out in a meeting we were having the other day that she gets yelled at every time by this friend of hers, every time we don't have a Make Me Smart question in this podcast. So here is a Make Me Smart question. It's from Jonathan Adler. The question again is, what is something you thought you knew but you were wrong about? Jonathan Adler, by the way, for those of you who didn't listen a couple of episodes ago, is a designer that we talked to, what, two-ish weeks ago? Anyway, here he is with the Make Me Smart question.
Whoa. I'm going to bring it into a business context. I was extraordinarily debt averse when I started, and I have learned that the capitalist system is built on wise use of debt, and I've used debt wisely, and it's really helped me build my business, albeit in a not terribly risky fashion.
That is totally true. And let me just say, putting on my marketplace host hat here for a minute, that there's a report out on consumer debt this week, which will show that consumer debt in this economy is at record levels. Debt is not all bad, right? It's a little bit like cholesterol. You want good debt, and then you want some lesser quantity of kind of risky debt. Thus endeth my sermon. And that's where the music starts. Because nobody needs to hear more of me just riffing all by myself. That's my rule, actually. All right, so do this for us. Subscribe to the show. Tell a friend. Go to Apple Podcasts, wherever you subscribe to your podcast, and just hook us up and share it and tweet about it and all that good stuff. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner does our digital stuff for us. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. The theme music was, I've been corrected on that, was composed by that very same Ben Tolliday and a guy by the name of Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand around here is Sitar Nieves. Senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And this is what the music sounds like. We're just going to let it play, because usually it's me and Molly talking. And now we're not going to do that. We'll just let it play. You guys can hear it. Oh, but it's longer than my little cute riff would have allowed, so now I'm stuck. Oh, there it is. Trained radio professional people.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.